Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to episode 683 with my guest, Dale. You're listening to the Mental Illness Happy Hour. If you're new, this is a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads. I am not a therapist. And this is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm a jackass that cooked chicken on basic cable, but I'm also a little bit nuts. I've battled a lot of things in the lab. I don't know why I pronounce battled like that. Like all of a sudden I'm a Midwestern morning DJ. I started this podcast because when I was at the depths, the darkest times of my life, specifically about 20 plus years ago, I thought there was no hope. I thought I was alone. And once I began to recover and feel hope and develop tools to cope, I thought, I think a podcast would help people and I think I would enjoy doing it. And here I am 13 years later. Holy shit. And that's weird because I'm only 14 years old. Yes, I was just a baby. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Diesel. And about her bulimia, she writes, like a secret ball and chain no one can see, alone, always alone with this monster that won't let me be happy. Thank you for that. That is that's deep. That's the part wanting to feel invisible and yet hating that we feel invisible. I think so much of life is just wanting to control the way in which we're seen. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by a guy who called, I don't know what this means, fake Vittorio Tondelli. I have the feeling it's probably a TV character, maybe a movie character. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? He lists a bunch, but I'm just going to read one because boy, does it just distill it down. He writes, everyone will discover sooner or later who you really are. Boy. Oh, that feeling that we have to hide this part of ourselves to stay safe. And yet, ironically, the real freedom and vulnerability is sharing that with, finding safe people to share that with, not toxic people, because then that just reinforces the feeling of rejection and not enoughness. This is a happy moment filled out by our friend TR, and he writes, I was recently accused of making a threat by a former friend. Couldn't be further from the truth. People have been very supportive and told me they don't believe the accusation. One friend of mine believes in the power of crystals, in parentheses, I don't. He gave me a big hug the next time he saw me. Then he reached into his pocket to get the smoky quartz he always has with him. I think you need this more than I do, he said as he handed me his special crystal. I still don't believe in the power of crystals, but in that moment, I felt love. I felt heard and seen. I almost cried right there. This was something important to him, and he gave it to me. That smoky quartz is still in my pocket, and when I'm down, I hold it and remember a beautiful moment with a friend. I love that. I mean, isn't that what we're after? We just think money or popularity or at those moments when I feel connected and loved, it's like the rest of the world, just the problems, you know, quote, unquote, problems, just have a different perspective on them. This is from the religious abuse / trauma survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Me. And she writes, I can remember one of the many churches my mom took us to as children as being particularly frightening. I remember two women who attended and regularly became, quote, possessed, unquote, by God. They would scream out in tongues, which for anyone familiar is a fake language used by many to speak to God. And they'd roll around on the floor, flopping their arms and legs around. As a young girl, I was terrified at some things I witnessed. By the way, how do you know if somebody's having a seizure? That would be a terrible time to have a seizure. However, one of the scariest days after church was when I overheard some women from the church asking my mom if my little sister and I were old enough to start wearing their hair in buns. They already didn't like my sister and I, and that was in parentheses in case it was confusing or in quotes as to who was saying it. They already didn't like my sister and I to be allowed to wear pants. It sounds like a good church. My heart sank thinking about how the way I wear my hair was no longer going to be an option for me. My father already prohibited the cutting of a girl's hair, and now this too? Thank God, my mother tends not to make friends for very long, and my next church was much more lenient on hair and clothes. I love that that's a positive, that your mom's a bridge burner. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Raven Black. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? That I need to eat less because I am fat and need to lose weight. That nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. That is a horrible t-shirt. Nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. I fucking love when somebody does a struggle in a sentence and they just condense it so eloquently. Now, I don't struggle with bulimia, but I've been doing reading the struggle in a sentence surveys for, God, probably a decade. I've read hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of them. And you guys paint such a picture of your struggles, and when you do it poetically and succinctly, I'm just, I don't know, so grateful. This is from the Fear survey, and this is filled out by a trans woman in her 20s who calls herself still not sad enough to be a famous artist, I guess. I think we've read some of her surveys before. And she writes, I'm afraid that no matter how educated, successful, emotionally intelligent, talented, conventionally attractive, etc., that I become, I will never have a long-term romantic partner and will die alone because being a trans woman makes me untouchable to the overwhelming majority of men on the planet. I'm afraid that I will ultimately have to settle with only ever being someone else's quick fling experiment, fetish object, and or embarrassing secret. I'm afraid that everybody is only humoring me and that nobody is actually capable of seeing me as a woman. I'm afraid that by the time I've finished the rest of my transition and pass as a woman 100% of the time, that I will still be unwantable because I will be too old to be attractive. And I fear that I will die feeling like I was never seen in the first place. Thank you for that. And man, isn't it all about, maybe I'm repeating myself, but about feeling seen, validated. We're going to take a quick break, see if we have any sponsors. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Falcon. And she writes, I've struggled with severe general anxiety my whole life. So when I developed tinnitus, a constant, inescapable ringing sound in one of my ears at the beginning of 2024, I was, unsurprisingly, not coping well. After 3 ENT appointments, a hearing test, an MRI, and hours of ill-advised and generally terrifying web searches, failed to unearth much hope. I took the afternoon off from work to see a specialist, an hour's drive from home. It was a long shot, but I was desperate to hear some advice, any advice beyond learn to live with it, because there's no cure and it's not going away. After the 10-minute consultation with the specialist, it was clear he also did not possess a magic wand, and my far-flung hopes were once again shattered. I left the office in tears of fear and hopelessness. Was I condemned to hearing this accursed ringing in my ear for every moment the rest of my life? Would I never again enjoy a moment of quiet? I started my drive home in a cold sweat, near panic. Waiting at a stoplight, fumbling for distraction, I opened my music app to the first station tagged as relaxing. The first song started to play. It was an instrumental cover of The Sound of Silence.
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out.
All my alters have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lives.
A kind pimp.
Yes.
The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, you first. And I said, I might be gay. I was with a girl. And I said, and what do you have to tell me? She said, I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session.
I'm here with Dale. I met you in a support group years ago. And then our paths crossed a couple of weeks ago. Again.
Mm, yes.
And you were kind enough to accept my invitation to come talk about social and sexual anorexia.
Yes.
Which doesn't get talked about a whole lot. And I think a lot of inside the recovery rooms and outside the recovery rooms. Where do we begin? And when we're using the word anorexia, for anybody who's not familiar with social insanity, social and sexual anorexia, it has nothing to do with the food anorexia.
I would also add that there's an emotional anorexia piece to that too. So it's all three things.
Yeah. So give a broad overview, and then we'll go into the details, but give a broad overview, if you would, to somebody who's kind of scratching their head right now going, what are you talking about? You know, what are some of the ways that you avoid those types
of situations?
Situations, ways of healthily giving yourself those things that the average human being kind of needs. You know, the human connection.
I've always been afraid, and you know, shyness of people, of unfamiliar situations, possibly authority figures. And this all starts very early. You know, I think I was competitive, but I didn't like to lose, so I avoided those kinds of things, sports. But I didn't know that at the time. I was just afraid. So I tended to spend a lot of time by myself.
Did you have siblings?
I have a younger brother. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember a lot about my childhood, but I remember, you know, we did a lot of things. We were, in some ways, we had an amazing childhood. We were exposed to different things. We lived on Lake Sammamish when we were, you know, young. And so we...
Where's that?
That's outside of Bellevue, Washington.
Oh, beautiful.
And we had a... my dad was in sales, rented a house that was on the lake. It happened to be in probate. He had tried to buy it, but it was probably on an acre lakefront property, and we had wealthy neighbors, and so we got to partake in a lot of things that other kids didn't get to do. So, but I've always felt separate and apart from people.
What were some of your earliest memories of feeling apart and different? Were there any particular situations, or was it just a general kind of voice in your head?
I think it was a general voice, but I also, it was terrified of getting punished, making a mistake, you know, all those things that a lot of kids have, but I reacted much more strongly to it than...
Inwardly or outwardly? Or both?
Both.
Did it draw the attention of your parents? Like, what's going on? Why are you so afraid of this?
Well, I think at start, I was willful, you know, and I learned how to say no, and... That didn't matter, you know, and back in those...
What do you mean? You learned how to say no, but it didn't matter.
Because it didn't matter if I didn't want to do something, I had to do it anyway.
And is this under the healthy realm of discipline and structure by a parent, or was this kind of over the line?
In today's standards, I think it would have been over the line. I mean, back in those days, you know, women were seen and not heard.
And you're how old?
I'm 72.
Okay.
And we were taught to just be quiet, not say anything, and don't speak unless you're spoken to. There was an undercurrent of women were sort of second-class citizens. And my mother, I perceived as being very weak and passive.
Was your father domineering?
Very much so. And rageful. He suffered from PTSD from the war. And I was first born, so I was the lightning rod. So I would get punished for little things that, you know, I mean, I spilled my milk and I'd get dragged into the other room and spanked, you know.
Did you have any idea at the time that this was related to your dad's experience in the war?
No, I had no idea. This has all been recent that I've come to realize, you know, and his child, it's generational trauma that's passed on, you know, and I have understanding and compassion at this point in my life. And I will say that I had a very rocky relationship with my father, and we didn't speak for over 20 years. And I hated him. I blamed him for all my faults, right? And I felt like I got the negative aspects of both my parents, and I didn't get any of the positive
good
ones.
Job. Good job.
Yeah, I've come to realize that's not true, but... But it took me a long time. I couldn't see it, you know? And so I just was afraid and created a life around feeling safe.
What were the ways that you remember soothing yourself?
Food, sugar. I mean, I think I was stealing candy and cookies when I was first grade, kind of. I think first or second grade, I was pleasantly plump, you know, and but my parents were worried, and they took me to a doctor who put me on diet pills.
God, you really did grow up in the 50s. Holy shit.
And my mother took Dexedrine while she was pregnant with me so she wouldn't gain weight. So, you know, and smoked and drank and all those things. So, yeah, we've come a long way, huh?
We have.
Yeah, so I was wrong. I didn't realize it. I mean, I was rebelling against what I thought was... an oppressive environment, and I had no support. My mother told me that I rejected her at birth.
I don't know.
That's what she said.
You storm out of the room on your little baby legs.
I know. You know, anyway, she told me that, not all that long ago, before she died. But I was so stunned. I didn't know how to say, well, what do you mean by that? You know, but that was Dr. Spock. Those were in the days where you let a baby cry, they'll cry it out. They didn't want me to wake them up in the morning, so they would put a bowl of cereal in my crib. So, you know, I had something to eat.
And for the younger people, she's referring to Dr. Benjamin Spock, not Leonard Nimoy, or however you pronounce his last name. Yeah, he was a pop culture phenomenon.
Yes, he was.
And a medical doctor who...
And women followed him.
My mom did as well.
Yeah, parents followed his... I mean, whatever he said, that was mm-hmm. God's... You know, that was a voice from God. And yeah, so that was the era that I grew up in. And, you know, I'm sure other people had much worse treatment. You know, I was always told you've got food on the table and a roof over your head, you know, be grateful. And I did the best I could. I was considered very bright, but I felt stupid because that's the environment I grew up in.
Were you told, you know, you mm-hmm. failed here, you know?
Yeah, well, I didn't do it right.
And was this your dad or your mom or both?
Both of them, but primarily my dad. And she went along with whatever he said.
So. Gotcha. And would there be anger attached to it?
Mm-hmm. And anger was not tolerated in the house.
By you?
Yeah, by us children.
Right. But your dad expressed it.
Yeah. And my mother, I never saw her get angry.
Would your dad just express it verbally, or was there physical displays of anger?
There was, I mean, he didn't beat us. We got spanked, you know, and, but it was the look. I mean, you mm-hmm. just, I was afraid of that man. And I, to this day, I can still go there, but, I did my best not to aggravate him. But there were, let's just say there were a lot of expectations. And I, you know, I mean, I had potential. I was told I had talent. I could do my mother, before she met my dad was accepted on a scholarship to San Francisco Conservatory of Music for piano. And she did not go because she ended up marrying my dad. So we always had a piano in the house. But I don't know. I felt like, you know, I had piano lessons. But as a kid, I didn't want to practice. And they gave up because it was too much of a battle. So I stopped.
So talk about your relationships in school, or lack of.
You know, we moved quite a bit, so I remember when we were in Lake Sammamish, I had neighbors who were friends, but we were only there for like 3 years, and then we moved to Minnesota for 4 months, and then moved back to California, in the Bay Area. And so I think I was in the fourth grade at that point. And I remember I had friends, but I didn't make any lifelong friends. I do have a friend from high school, that we're still friends, but everybody else I've lost touch with. So yeah, I didn't have any strong connections as a kid.
So let's fast forward. And are we skipping over any big events, vignettes, kind of that you feel were emblematic of your?
Oh, well, I would say somewhere around 11 or 12. I fell off a horse about that time, and I had a hit it. I was unconscious. I don't know what part that plays in everything, but, and the time wise, I don't remember, but my dad would lecture. That was his favorite thing to do. And I got lectured a lot. So, and I eventually just shut down. I stopped talking, literally stopped talking, except that when I went to school, I think I talked. I didn't talk much in school either, but I had the ability to speak. Let me just say that. And so they sent me to therapy. And the therapist, it was a psychologist. And at the time he said, this is a family issue. I remember, and my dad says he doesn't remember this at all, but I remember that the therapist had said, or that my parents, they went to one session and then they didn't want to go back. They were afraid that they might end up in a divorce.
They said that to you, or
I don't know where I heard it somewhere. Gotcha. And I don't know where I heard it. So that's what stuck in my mind. And I ended up seeing that man for, I don't know, probably through high school.
Do you feel like it helped?
No. Well, I will say this. I didn't know this, but he told my dad to back off, give me some space. So I think that was a good thing.
Your dad did listen?
He did. But he basically just didn't have anything to do with me, pretty much, except what was necessary. It did allow me to go to the Monterey Pop Festival, though.
Oh, my God.
And I was at, you know, the Summer of Love. I was a wannabe hippie. I never quite, you know, I was much too conservative for that. But I did as much as I possibly could. And sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, I was, yeah, free love, all of that. I did my best to partake of
I
could have.
Did you do that because you wanted to, or you wanted to fit in?
I think I wanted to. I mean, there was a freedom there, and drugs. Well, that's when I got drugs and alcohol allowed me to. I mean, alcohol was liquid courage for me, you know. It enabled me to step out and do things that I ordinarily wouldn't do. So it took away that fear.
Interacting with people.
Mm-hmm.
Be sexual with someone, was alcohol necessary?
Yeah, I would say so. Because it was such a big part of my life. I mean, I was a virgin until I was 18, which in those days was, I was old. But alcohol was involved in that. You know, when I was 16, I went on a summer vacation with a friend and her family, and we were up in the Russian River, and there were some guys, so that was 67, Summer of Love. Mm-hmm. And we hooked up with these guys, and, you know, we had fun and heavy petting, making out and all that kind of stuff. And I had braces all through high school. So what I didn't realize until after the fact, I actually went to see this guy afterwards, and I saw how he lived, and he was a speed freak and used needles, and I didn't know that at the time, and I ended up coming down with Hep C. So I was 16, but I got that because of the braces, you know.
Oh, because your
cutting my
skin
lips
was exposed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we didn't know what it was back. I mean, we knew it was hepatitis, but it wasn't until the 90s that they figured out it was such a thing as Hep C.
Is that a lifelong thing?
It can be. It usually don't develop any symptoms until 20 or 30 years later. And it can lead to liver cancer and cirrhosis. But I was successfully treated.
Oh, good.
I was almost in cirrhosis. And that's a whole nother story, but it was successfully treated. So,
okay. So the Summer of Love, you're coming out of your shell. Talk about, I mean, you just mentioned one, I guess you could call it a relationship. if two dates count as a relationship, talk about when. Talk about a romantic connection or lack thereof.
Okay.
When you began to notice that there were hurdles, or, you know, whatever the issue was, because obviously years later you came into support groups. So I'm kind of wondering, when did the issues begin to surface that ultimately brought you into support groups? And what did that look like?
Well, my initial, I got married, and I myself was an alcoholic. I also developed bulimia when I was 27. I read a magazine article, and I thought, oh, that's a good idea. That's a way to control my weight, right? So this is my twisted thinking, yeah. You know? But I had multiple relationships, and I lived with two guys before I got married.
At the same time?
No, okay. No. Different times, and actually three, when I think about it. Sequential. Mm-hmm. I was faithful in one. and not faithful in two of them.
What do you remember thinking or feeling about your decision to be unfaithful?
I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy in the relationship, but I wasn't emotionally available. Neither were they. I mean, just, you know, two alcoholics, because that was, we drank, and that we just, and we did drugs, and that's just what we did. And
right.
And so that allowed me to be in the relationship, and then I got married, and I was married for 13 years. I left that relationship after 11 because the red flags. There were things early on in the marriage that I saw.
Were the qualities of your dad and the guy that you chose?
Well, I didn't. They were, actually, but I didn't know that until after we were married. I really didn't get to know him, and I was very attracted to him, and there was this very strong pull, lust. And I thought he had all the qualities that I was looking for, right? And he didn't. But once we ended up, we had a business together, and initially I stood my ground. I was able to say, I don't like this, or this isn't right, or we need to do something different. But eventually I gave up. I was very complacent, and it was too much work, too hard, and I didn't know what else to do. I didn't feel I could leave.
Listening to you, trying to make it work with an untreated alcoholic, of course, we can laugh about it now because we've been in support groups and we know that, you're trying to climb Mount Everest in flip-flops.
Exactly.
But at the time, you're like, why can't I be a better mountain climber and change him?
I do hike in my flip-flops, by the way. Not Mount Everest. But yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So you get out of your marriage. What next?
Well, first I got sober.
And how long are you still sober?
Yes.
How long have you been sober?
Oh, a little over 31 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm grateful. And I was forced. I was given the opportunity. I mean, I knew my drinking was a problem, but I was terrified. I didn't want to let, because it was medication for me. It allowed me to, while it was killing me, it allowed me to think I was part of the mm-hmm. world. And, I was threatened with loss of my job because of my drinking. And so I was offered, after the second warning, these were a year apart, I was offered treatment. And I said yes, because I knew I needed help. A day had not gone by when I didn't think about drinking. And I drank every day. So the idea of not was just terrifying to me. But once I got in that treatment center, I knew it was it. They say one day at a time, right? But I knew that was forever. Maybe one day at a time, but I can never drink again. I knew that. Mm-hmm. But once I accepted that, and the obsession to drink was gone. So, and it's never come back. So I'm extremely grateful.
And I would assume that you put work in the present day into maintaining your sobriety.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And so once I didn't have any drugs or alcohol, and at the end it was just alcohol, I realized what a prude I really was. And And a relationship terrified me because I lost myself in the relationship with my husband. He was also a sex addict, sex and love addict, you know, which I identify with. Because when I was drinking and using, I was very promiscuous. And but once that went away, there's no way I could do that. So I just... I had opportunities, but I just said no. I was incapable of being in a relationship.
Talk about what that looks like in terms of the thoughts that go through your head when an opportunity is presented, the thoughts that go through your head, whether it's future tripping, catastrophizing, what you feel, if anything, in your body.
That's difficult because I sort of disassociate. I like the idea of a relationship, but I also enjoy my life, and I'm very, very happy with my life on my own. The idea of you know, I don't know if I don't know if I can identify. Well, I'll tell you, whenever I'm confronted with something that I feel like I'm put on the spot, whether it be a relationship at work or with a boss or...
You're talking about a romantic relationship?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
A connection.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem necessarily with a man if I'm not attracted to him. As soon as, if I feel like they have, you know, there's some power, I mean, it's power and control, right? Trying to manage things. If I feel threatened in any way, I retreat, I withdraw, I go into this place of confusion, overwhelm, threat. I just pull away. I do have difficulty talking or expressing myself. I started dating a while back, which is something I hadn't done for many, many years.
And hold that thought.
Okay.
Where you are. What was the catnip for you? What were the qualities that would attract you, however brief, to a man, if there was a type, especially personality traits?
Well, somebody that I found attractive.
So physical?
Physical attraction. Musicians. I don't know. Sometimes there's just, I get a sense about people. Somebody who I might not find attractive necessarily, but there's something, there is an attraction there, not maybe not physically, but.
And would they be people who felt safe or people who were kind of chaotic and there was an allure to that?
I don't think I used to be attracted to bad boys, you know, not so much anymore. I don't know, you know,
it's okay. I was just curious. So pick up your thought then where you were.
Where was I?
Yeah. So you were talking about how you would kind of shut down, around, you know, authority figures.
And then I was talking about dating and I guess it comes down to I have poor boundaries. I don't know what's mine, what's yours. So an enmeshment kind of codependent kind of behaviors.
Also include you crossing other people's boundaries or mostly you not enforcing your own?
Both.
Okay.
I'm just beginning to realize that that's a necessary piece in a relationship so that I feel that I'm protected.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples where you would cross the person's boundaries and they would cross yours, whether they were expressed and set or not?
Oh, I mean, I would just say sharing with somebody, like it's called trauma bonding, mm-hmm. you know, where you overshare. You know.
I know nothing about that, Dale. My God.
But you feel like there's an attachment.
It's a high.
There's an identification there, and you're going, a sympathetic soul or right. somebody who understands me, you know. And then I'm, you know, there's to rescue or be rescued. You know, I think I'm a rescuer. The day I had to fly to Reno to finalize our divorce papers, and as my now ex-husband was driving me back to the airport, there was a part of me that knew he needed to be taken care of, you know, and that I almost like threw all of that out the window and went back. But there was a part of me that said, remember, no, Dale, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want that anymore. And, but it was a really strong pull.
And was that pull merely you not wanting to imagine him unable to care for himself, or was there also an attraction to that being quote unquote needed to help him survive?
I think it was an attraction to be needed. That yeah. I, you know, and traditionally women have been the emotional support for their men. And yeah, but that, no.
And would it be fair to say that there was a question inside you of who I am? Who am I if someone doesn't need me? Or is it?
Yeah. I mean, when I got sober, when I stopped drinking, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I liked, what I didn't like. Just everything terrified me. It was, I mean, even just to read in front of people was terrifying. And it took me a long, long time to I would rather do things alone. It's just easier. But I can't do this by myself.
You mean recovery?
Recovery.
No matter what the issue is.
Yeah. Yeah. Life. You can't do it by yourself, you know, as much as I would like to. And it's been a very slow process of getting to know who I am. You know, I feel like I've always been about healing and taking, you know, as a kid, I injured animals, birds, whatever, I would bring them home, you know, and I would try and help them. And then helping people, maybe even if they didn't want to be helped.
Now you're ringing some bells. You know, and the through line, which I'm sure you're aware of, is control through all of this. And it's amazing how we will lie to ourselves or maybe we're not even aware of it, that underneath all of this is us trying to make ourselves feel comfortable, you know, with the illusion that we can control things that we can't control, whether it's relationships or perfectionism and starting a project and not finishing it.
All of that. I mean, that underlies everything.
Everything.
I still struggle with that, you know, and what I found out is my, you know, I'm self-pity. I go into self-pity a lot, and And, you know, depression has been part of my life off and on. And poor me, you know, I'm helpless and hopeless, and you know, I can't take care of myself, so I need somebody to take care of me, you know. So I've found strong men as bosses to take care of me, mm-hmm. you know. Not
and when you she used air quotes for bosses, meaning not someone who's your literal boss, but somebody. Or do you mean literal bosses?
Literal bosses.
Okay.
Literal bosses.
So
yeah.
You're not talking romantically take care of you. You're meaning emotionally or both?
Both. And I mean, when I got married, I wanted to be taken care of. I wanted somebody who had money, who, you know, so I wouldn't have to worry about that and all of that. And that wasn't the case.
Was sex ever a currency that you felt that you had to spend to get what you
mm-hmm.
wanted? Talk mm-hmm. about that.
Yeah. I mean, I always felt obligated. If I had sex, I mean, if a man was nice to me and took me out to dinner and did all those things, then that I owed him, that it was obligatory sex. But I also used, I mean, not consciously, but I also, at some level, I think, knew that my power as a woman was, my currency was sex. And I could use that to get what I wanted.
Was there ever a, you know, as you got into support groups and stuff, that there was an objectification of sorts going on from your end with the other person, not necessarily physically objectifying them, but using them as a vehicle to satisfy your self, you know, emotionally, I guess reducing them from a complex human being to an object for your own means.
I didn't know that at the time, but looking back and what I've learned through all these different groups, it was all for me. It was all selfish motives behind it. And I remember sometimes thinking, what do you mean I'm not the only person in your life? You know, you mean you have other people that are important to you? It was like, no. Yeah, but it was all about me. And I've always thought of myself, though, as a considerate person. I mean,
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can be a considerate person and still engage in these unhealthy coping mechanisms to survive, because for so many of us, they're on an unconscious level. I would encourage you to not throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, my therapist helped me understand that two seemingly contradictory things can be happening at the same time. You can be a compassionate, conscientious person and also have these moments where, you know, you stray from your ethical or moral compass in a kind of a way of just wanting to not feel whatever it is you're feeling.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Makes total sense. And you have a very eloquent way of stating that. I wouldn't have been able to come out with those words, but I have a tendency still to have that black and white thinking, mm-hmm. right and wrong, and yeah,
good or bad.
Yeah. Because I do enjoy doing things for people. I enjoy giving. You know, I remember when my husband turned 50. Was it 50? It had to have been 40. 40. Yeah, because I left shortly thereafter. but I'd never done this before, but I did a whole surprise party for him. And We had a coffin. We had, because he was just, he thought it was the end of the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were so many moving pieces, and had a limo come pick us up, and there were some, there was a black tie event at the Hyatt. This was in Lake Tahoe. And the guys ended up at the restaurant where we were having all of this. And so they were the pallbearers, and they lined. I mean, it was just, and it turned out beautifully. And I got joy from doing that and seeing how happy he was. And then when my birthday came around,
nothing.
It's like, okay, well.
So talk about when you decided to get help for your struggles with intimacy, whether it was avoiding it or being attracted to people who were unavailable, what was it? And how long ago was it that you were like, I need help?
Well, I mean, I've been in therapy on and off all my life. But I didn't know what the problem was. And I never felt talk therapy really helped all that much. And when I came into one, you know, I'd been sober for many, many, many years, and I went to another group, which is about relationships. And I did that whole thing, worked with this woman. And when we were all, everything was said and done, she looked at me and she said, you know, you really should have more recovery than what you do at this stage of the game. And I said, I know. And that's when she said, that's when the anorexia piece came in, the love avoidant piece. I didn't know there was such a thing. I knew there was something wrong. I couldn't tell you what it was. But she said, there's a place where you can go where they can help you with this. And that's when I think I found my tribe. I found a lot of people who had very similar experiences. Mm-hmm. And some very successful people, you just would never have any idea, but it's what's going on the inside,
yeah.
You know, and it's developmental trauma. It's childhood, generational, all of that stuff. And I didn't know about any of that. So that's only been the last, since just before the pandemic.
And do you, when you're in your emotional anorexia, are you longing for something but afraid to pursue it?
Mm-hmm.
Are there, okay. Go ahead.
I mean, it's going back. I never felt I had a voice. I felt my dad killed my spirit. And so periodically throughout my life, I sang in choirs. I auditioned for Hair when I was 21, and I did get a call back. But and they said, we're not going to bite you. I said, I know, but I took 30 milligrams of Valium, and I just was shaking like a leaf. And so obviously that didn't work out. And then I was drawn to sound therapy, and finding your voice over the years, but never really found anything that worked until the pandemic. And I found this woman through what's called the Shift Network, and she,
SHIFT.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I should say any names or not. She's an English woman, Chloe Goodchild, and she's been doing voice work she had an experience in India back in the 90s, and and I, my apologies, Chloe, if I don't say this right, but her mission was, and she was a singer before, and she worked with, she performed and worked with choirs, and she was just, the Western culture and educational system was very frustrating for her. And when she came back from India, she wanted to bring the East and the West together. And so she, I've been taking multiple courses. I've actually gone to England twice to attend workshops. And, you know, and the first one was Empower Your Soul's Voice. So it's all about finding your own authentic voice and speaking your truth, finding it, and finding that source within yourself where you are empowered to speak and to bring forward what you came here to bring to the world. And her work just really speaks to me. So that has helped me in many ways. I still have yet to find my voice, but I am speaking.
And you feel like you're facing in the right direction, even if they're baby steps?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And that is, I think, such a huge thing to highlight, because in our black and white thinking, we're like, well, I've been doing this a month, and I'm not president of the universe yet, so I must be a failure, or this must not work.
Yeah. No, and I have learned over the years, because it's, change has been very slow for me. And that there's a saying that's progress, not perfection. And then I heard somebody else say, well, it's spiritual progress, not perfection. And it takes work.
It does.
It's hard work.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time.
And I would also add that it's not all torture along
no,
the way. Yes,
no.
There's moments of discomfort, but there are also moments of connection and joy that our catastrophizing brains would never have imagined. Maybe I should just speak for myself.
Well, I have had moments of pure joy and love and connection that I thought my heart was going to burst, you know. Beautiful, beautiful things that I don't think I was capable of feeling back in the day. But still, it's a very, you know, social media I can't do. Sales I can't do. I mean, there's a lot of things that just,
that's good you know that about yourself, though, because I don't think that means there's something unhealthy going on. I think that's you just honoring who you are.
Well, I thought there was something wrong with me because I couldn't do this. Other people can do this, and it does. It's, what's the big deal? And I'm going, I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong with me. See, I still haven't found that place.
I think there's people who are jealous right now listening to you going, I wish I could get off social media. Yeah. Now, that to me sounds totally healthy. If you were like, I can't leave my house to go meet a friend who I feel safe with, I would be like, well, that might, you know, need some looking at.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that, you know, that means you're broken or this is wrong. But now, you know, when you shared in that meeting that we were at, I hope this doesn't sound cheesy, but there was a light in you as you shared about your struggle with anorexia, where I could see that this was a person who is so capable of having connections with people, who has stuff to offer, and I don't know how to describe it, but it was, here is somebody who has something to offer to the world. Here is somebody who has a warmth that it touched me.
Well, thank you for saying that. because I don't, I feel like I have that inside of me, but I don't feel like I'm able to extend that or, and I, only that particular room that where we, that you're talking about, for some reason, I feel very safe in that room.
It's a really special place.
It is. I mean, it is. It is. There's something there that you don't find in other places.
No.
And because I was able to open up and speak in front of 75 people when I first went there, and that was astounding to me that I was able to do that, because I, in other rooms with less than that, I freeze. Nothing comes out. So, yeah. And I've been told often enough that there's something in me.
Yeah.
But it only comes out every once in a while. I have no control.
Well, I would suggest that it's there even when you don't feel it or recognize it. You know, we can't see the look in our eyes when we're talking to someone else. And they often know more about what's going on in us or how safe we are than we ourselves do. And I sensed that in you, which is why I wanted to have you as a guest. I felt like this is somebody who I think has a lot to share and is capable of being vulnerable and transparent, which to me is the opposite of anorexia. So it's like I could sense this wall of water behind the dam.
Well, there is a wall of water, and I think that wall of water, Fantasia, do you remember? Did you see the original Fantasia?
Yeah.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Yes. Yes.
I think I'm Mickey Mouse, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm terrified of being overrun by water, you know? And maybe I have to be okay with that, you know?
Yeah.
And letting go and just going with the flow and not worrying about it so much.
Some of the most profound moments in my recovery have been me accepting other people's perception of how they see me through their eyes. And that's why I think support groups are so important, because if we strictly go about how we see ourselves through our own distorted thinking, it's a really lonely, distorted reality. And I talk about support groups all the time, but if I didn't go to them, I wouldn't get to meet someone like you. Dale, I'm so grateful that you braved whatever fears you might have had about coming in and sharing your life and giving us a peek into the battles with emotional anorexia. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Paul.
What a lovely human being. And it sounded like she was really struggling to take that compliment in right there at the end. We are going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Before I take it out with a stack of surveys, just want to mention a couple of things. We still need support on Patreon. I feel like an asshole asking for this every week, but we really, really do. And I've been adding things to the different tiers. Most recently, I forget which tier. Could I be less prepared for mentioning what tiers we have? But we have, it's the tier started at the $1, and the $20 one, there's a $1, $5, $20. I think there's one in between there as well. And it goes up from there, but we have a variety of things. You, one of the $20 a month, you can join our Sunday Zoom support group hangout. Another tier, I believe it's the $10 a month, or maybe it's the $5 a month. Oh my God, you are such a disaster. You can hear the extra surveys that I hold back and read just for Patreon people. Their videos, behind-the-scenes stuff, my woodworking, pictures of my girlfriend and Gracie, and somebody requested more videos of Gracie, so I'm gonna start doing that after she gets groomed. She's a little bit of a mess right now, and honestly, a little embarrassing. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Richard. This one is fucking heavy. We're diving right in. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? And he writes, you are the most selfish, self-absorbed, self-important person imaginable. You should have answered the fucking phone. You said you'd end up being a better dad than your old man, but when your daughter was dying, you were too busy to answer. Quote, there was no way you could have known, unquote, your wife says, because she's somehow able to overlook your massive personality flaws and give you the benefit of the doubt. She says no one could have known a school shooting would ever happen in your peaceful little town. But if you had a choice, you could have been the kind of father who answered the phone in the middle of the day whenever his kid called. Instead, you didn't. And now you'll never get another phone call again. And you have the audacity to be sad about that when you weren't there for your baby when she needed you. You're alive, and you caused her to die alone, and you're sitting here acting like you're the victim. That's so pompous and self-aggrandizing, and it's sickening. She went through pain you can't imagine. You don't have the right to cry about this. You didn't die. She did. It should have been you. Your daughter was a better person than you. Fuck. Man, I am so sorry for your loss and to have it happen in such an awful way. And that just seems to be a part of our brain that when something horrible happens, especially when someone we love dies, that we find a way to blame ourselves. And I would just, if you're listening, I would ask you, if there is an afterlife, do you think your daughter wants you beating yourself up? Or do you think if she could reappear, she would hug you and say, Dad, I love you. You were a great dad. I'm okay. This is from the Love Survey. This is filled out by Frankie. And, I love this one. Frankie writes, I love the assurance I feel when protecting myself in little moments from nasty people. That is such a huge one. That is such a fucking great tool for self-care. It's like when we don't have those tools, the world feels so overwhelming, and the things we do to cope with the anxiety and dread, at least maybe I should speak for myself, but once I started learning how to set boundaries and distance myself or even cut people out of my lives, my life that are, I have multiple lives, that are toxic, it just made life so much better. Frankie also writes, I love sex, even though I've chosen to not have it, at least for a while. I love Atlantic beaches and East Coast brashness. I love a friendly neighbor. And I love these little vegan chocolate date pies that they have at the grocery store. That seems like an interesting combination, chocolate and date. I got to question that, because it seems like neither of those need to be friends. Chocolates and dates. Yeah, Frankie, I gotta have a heart-to-heart with you, because that seems like a bad matchmaker. And as a result, I cast you to hell. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by Heart Hands. And he writes to the question, what are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? You're more than grown up. You're 40 now, and you've worked your ass off in therapy for a few years. So this is speaking from my experience in helping you deal with life challenges when I say you are physically revolting, unable to give love, and don't deserve love of any kind, not even from your cat. Not even close. Sorry, buddy. Also, every little move you make turns into a huge mistake. That's quite a fucking talent. Best to accept it. You're the worst kind of person. But I say that with compassion, and here's a boatload of, quote, healthy coping skills, unquote, to get you through the next 40 years. Please, dear God, no more than 40, but hopefully much less. Any comments to make the podcast better? Donuts. You know what? I am going to run that by the steering committee and the board and the CFO and the CEO, but not the comptroller, because I don't know what comptrollers do. I think they control the comps. I could be wrong. I took a little Latin as a baby. Dude. Thank you for that. That kind of made me want to laugh and cry at the same time. This is from the Love Survey filled out by Zellers. And they write, I love that our 75-pound pit bull mix is so scared of the broom that he won't eat his food if the broom is too close by. That is fantastic. I love setting my alarm 30 minutes earlier than I have to, so I have some time to stay cozy in bed, listening to my partner sleeping peacefully. I don't understand why anybody wouldn't set their alarm extra early to not have to go right into your day. I find it so jolting. So I often set my alarm like an hour earlier than I need, and then I can just go, fuck the day, snooze. I get to appreciate about 5 seconds of knowing that I have more time to sleep, and then I'm sleeping. They also write, I love coming home from work and swapping stories with my partner about our day, feeling so seen and safe. Those are awesome. Thank you for those. This is from the Shame and Secret survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Short Angry Cardinal Bird. He identifies as straight. He's in his 30s. Says that he was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. I would say way more than slightly. He's never been sexually abused. He's been emotionally abused. He writes, my father and, to a much lesser extent, my mother were cold and distant to me throughout my childhood. Any attempt to express emotions or allow myself to be vulnerable were met with indifference at best and mockery at worst. As a young boy growing up in the South, showing emotion was viewed as weakness. To my father, I was a pussy, an F-word, a girly man, all because I had a tough time hiding my sensitivity. I didn't like sports and I wasn't the outdoorsy type. I liked music and video games and reading. My father didn't understand this, and instead of making any attempt to embrace my interests, chose to keep his distance or outright ridicule me for the things I enjoyed. All of this was compounded by his functional alcoholism. If he wasn't working, he was drinking, and when he drank, he was an absolute dick. He would gaslight me and the rest of my family about his drinking. According to him, he never got drunk. He didn't have a problem. We had no clue what we were talking about. Even once, I started to have my own issues with alcohol abuse. In my late teens, he would treat me as if I were completely ignorant on the topic. Fortunately, I'm 12 years sober now, in big part due to worries that I would eventually end up like him. Those worries weren't unfounded. My father is now experiencing late-stage cirrhosis. His drinking picked up considerably when he retired at the start of the pandemic. It turned into an all-day, everyday sort of thing. He's been in the hospital at least a half a dozen times for issues related to drinking. This includes pancreatitis, severe dehydration, etc. He doesn't want to stop drinking. He's outright refused every ounce of help anyone has offered him over the past few years. At this point, he can barely walk, has vision problems, and is exhibiting symptoms of hepatic encephalopathy, which almost feels like a quick-moving dementia. Most of the time, he can't tell you what day it is or what his kids' names even are, but he does still drink, and he drinks a lot. I love my mother, but she is somewhat of an enabler. The way she sees it, at least if she buys his beers, he's not going to try driving himself to get it. It's kind of fucked up, but I get where she's coming from. My dad and I have no real relationship at this point. We were low contact before this, but now it's complete radio silence. If I tried calling him, he wouldn't even answer. But I don't know if it's because he doesn't care or if he doesn't even realize the phone is ringing. My brother also keeps his distance. He has two kids of his own and is an excellent father. When our dad started treating my niece and nephew the same way he treated me growing up, my brother quickly moved to cut that cancer out of his life. If one good thing has come from this is that my mother and I are much closer than we used to be. Those same emotions I used to be chastised for are now embraced. Who knew being empathetic and caring could actually be a good thing? Any positive experiences with the abusers? My parents did provide for me. My brother nor I ever went hungry or without. We lived in a solid, lower middle class household. My dad always worked, often 60 plus hours a week, and viewed this as a source of pride. Though, looking back now, it's obvious that a big part of it was due to his avoidance of having to be around the rest of the family. He literally worked 12-hour days, 5 to 6 days a week, because that was preferable to spending time with his kids. Darkest thoughts. My father is going to die. It's not a matter of if, but when. There's a part of me that wishes it would happen already. He's made the decision to kill himself, and the rest of my family is miserable as a result. I genuinely believe I won't feel any sadness when it happens. Honestly, I imagine feeling a tremendous sense of relief, as if we can all move on with our lives. I also, and this is where I really feel scummy, daydream about the idea of the inheritance money that I'll receive when he passes. Despite working constantly while growing up and providing for us, he's made absolutely no attempt to help out once I transitioned into adulthood. When I was briefly homeless and nearly drinking myself to death, he refused to offer even the slightest bit of support financially, or definitely not emotionally. My inheritance will be enough that I can pay off my student loans and save up for a down payment on a house. Two major steps in bettering my own life and potentially starting a family. From tragedy comes new strength and whatnot. Darkest secrets. Despite the damage my father's drinking has done to our family, my own during my late teens and early 20s eclipsed his. No one knows the extent of my problem. At my peak, I was drinking a fifth of bourbon every single day. I did this for 2 years. Fortunately, I was extremely boring and would drink alone at home so I could watch reruns of Cops and eat shitty frozen food. I also have no lasting effects from said drinking. Yeah, is anybody ever doing anything healthy while they're watching Cops? Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. In my early 20s, I was falsely accused of sexual assault by an entirely consenting partner. This was someone who I loved and trusted, but lacked the maturity to talk about complex emotions when it really mattered. Instead, they broke things off with me after our first real sexual encounter and chose to tell their loved ones that I forced myself on them. As a result, sex became something of a traumatic thing for me for a very long time. It's warped my way of thinking about the subject, meaning I'm extremely timid and second-guess everything I do. My partner is receptive to this and has helped me work through my issues over the years. But due to this, my sexual fantasies really aren't all that powerful or dark. And there's a question mark. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to tell my father that his inability to be a dad and a decent person to me has forever fucked up the way I approach others. I can't maintain friendships with men because I had no father figure when I needed one. I would like to tell him about the countless hours I've spent in therapy asking myself why I'm broken, why I second-guess everything I say or do, and why I feel so little emotion for most people or things, despite knowing I have a huge heart. What, if anything, do you wish for? For Don Felder to reunite with the Eagles for a legitimate farewell tour. Don, for those of you who don't know, Don Felder was their guitar player and an amazing, amazing lead guitar player. Have you shared these things with others? My therapist and my partner know these things. They're receptive. My partner has a wonderful relationship with her parents, so there's definitely some aspects of the situation that she can't relate to, but she does her best. And you know the other thing that I think is cool about having a partner with a healthy relationship with their family is it can be kind of a way for us to go, oh, that's what it looks like. This is what's unacceptable. And sometimes we can kind of extrapolate that out to our other relationships and say, oh, you know, that her parents don't talk to her like that. So, you know, and they love each other. So why does this friend who supposedly loves me and I supposedly love talk to me? In a way, I don't know if that made any sense. I'm going to refund you that last 20 seconds. So contact me through your lawyer. How do you feel after writing these things down? Exhausted. I just spent the morning in therapy discussing the exact same thing. What, if anything, would you like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Your parents are people. People are dumb and make mistakes and can be total assholes. Just because they tell you you're wrong doesn't mean it's correct. Many times, they're the ones in the wrong. If you've grown up in a household without love or support, you're probably going to be a bit fucked up, but that's okay too. The best thing you can do is to tell yourself you're going to be fine. You may need a little help to get there, and you may not be able to fix everything that's broken, but you can be bigger than the mistakes of our mothers and fathers. So true. Thank you for that one. And then finally, I'm going to save some of these, the rest of these surveys for the Patreon. And I hope that came off as passive aggressively as I intended that. Finally, this is from the Love Survey, and this is filled out by Ro, and they just simply write, I love when my husband knows when I'm in my dark place, says nothing, and just holds me. No judgment, just love. That's so sweet. Who knew? Not me. For so many years. That most of the times you don't even have to say anything. You just need to be there. And by be there, I don't mean just physically. I mean, like, pay attention. If you're out there and you're struggling, you're feeling alone, I hope these last 84 minutes have helped you realize that our lives can get better, and it's just about finding our tribe, and your tribe is out there. Sometimes it fucking blows trying to find your tribe, but I really believe if we keep doing it, you know, I had a beautiful support group meeting last night. It was Valentine's Day, and one of the members put this little table in the middle of our circle, and it had these Valentine's Day treats that she had made and a candle. And it just reminded me that that was the place where I forged the template for what love looked like, because they loved me unconditionally. And they loved me enough for me to realize they couldn't all be bullshitting and that I might be worthy of love. And that changed everything. Everything. And it's one of the reasons why I do this podcast, in addition to loving the sound of my voice. So if you're out there, I hope you find your tribe. And just remember that you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.